Yeah, Steve, I sometimes wonder why we bother.
Bother with what?
We keep saying that we shouldn't make predictions and our prediction making are bad.
Oh yeah, and then we go ahead and make predictions anyway.
I said this on our last episode.
I think it's very unlikely, actually, we'll have a December election. If we end up with a December election, I think what will happen is, on Tuesday, Macron will kick off at the EU27. They'll ask for a two-week extension, initially. Mm-hmm. And they'll say, you've got 2 weeks to organise a democratic event. And it's going to be either a referendum or a general election. And in that instance, I can see potentially this parliament plumping for a general election over a referendum.
Now, I said that on the Saturday when we were recording Sunday's episode. And by the Tuesday, I was completely wrong. We now are in a middle of a snap election.
I think that might be a record for you actually being proven so wrong so quickly.
Well, because not only did we reach an election, but we also didn't reach one by the EU giving us an extension of just 2 weeks. So I was wrong, but also the premise for me being right was also wrong.
Kind of impressive, actually, mate.
So now we have a podcast which is prefiguring an upcoming general election in which I have to make yet more predictions and answer listeners' questions which are based around predictions. It's enough to drive a sane person to drink.
Speaking of drink, what you can probably do is create a drinking game around Christmas time where you take a shot for every prediction we get wrong.
Can we please not have too many Christmas-related... No one's bought any Christmas presents by the 12th of December, it'll all be fine. My mum today was saying, well, all the postal votes will be lost in the Christmas post. I think, who sent their... The deadline for postal votes will be the end of November, won't it? Who sends Christmas cards by the end of November? Planners, Steve, won't have it. We should have them in charge of Brexit. Right. Anyway, so we have a December election that's been brought about by a Conservative government searching for a mandate for its trade policy. That's right, folks. It's 1923 all over again. Champagne, a podcast that feels if it can't break its no alcohol rule now, it never will. My name's Corey Hazelhurst. I'm my almost sober partner in propaganda with Steve Haynes.
Yep. Hi, Corey.
The nice thing, I suppose, about making predictions is that we can talk about why they were wrong and in doing so reach a higher state of wisdom.
That's a very good way of looking at it. It's a very self-reflective way of looking at how wrong we are.
Absolutely. The kind of nirvana of incompetence. If Chris Grayling had done that, they'd be now making statues of him in Parliament Square. So let's just have a think. Why was I wrong about an early general election? I suppose it looks to me like there have been shifting tectonic plates, which maybe weren't so clear when we recorded on Saturday afternoon, but now are a bit clearer. And what seems to have happened is that the push for a December election was mainly engineered by the Lib Dems and the SNP. And that was essentially for tactical reasons, wasn't it?
They viewed the election as the last actual real chance to stop Brexit. They basically took a read of the parliamentary arithmetic, came to the conclusion the referendum bill, or a bill to get another referendum through, wasn't likely to pass. As such, the options were either have an election or see Boris Johnson pass the withdrawal bill. They've made the gamble then that, well, it's this or nothing.
So certainly I think that's the key Lib Dem thing, isn't it? I think they were quite spooked by the seeing 19 Labour MPs vote for the deal. And as we spoke about on our podcast last Sunday, a majority of 30 for the deal, quite a comfortable majority. And Ian Dunt wrote on politics.co.uk about actually saying a general election was Remainer's best chance. And having been on a couple of conversations on pro-EU campaigners in Birmingham, certainly a lot of the Lib Dems appear to have shifted to that view, that there isn't a majority in the House of Commons for a referendum, which is probably true. And therefore, it's just another gamble, isn't it? Let's talk about that gamble in a second. I think with the SNP, there's an extra level, which is in January, I believe, the trial of Alex Salmond begins. And there is a thought that for tactical reasons, the SNP want an election before that trial, because I think they're worried about their name being driven through the mud a little bit as a result of the trial proceedings.
Depending on how the trial goes and what's actually going to happen with it, Nicola Sturgeon gets dragged into it just because she was Alex Salmond's protege for so long. There might be some just awkward questions in general about how the SNP handled things, well, which could just be bad PR for them. Mm. As such, trying to have an election before that comes out in there from their perspective, especially when they've got a good kind of like cover in terms of, we need to stop this bill, Brexit, this is the only way we can do that. You know, tactically and strategically, it makes a lot of sense for them.
Helen Thompson on the Cambridge University Talking Politics podcast, she made a point, which I think is worth making, is that the Remain cause, they've essentially been playing tactics for months now without a clear strategy.
Yep.
And I suppose there were two main big schools of thought that are at play. One of them was essentially trying to push for a soft Norway-style Brexit and try and water down Johnson's deal. The Lib Dems certainly, and Tim Farron at the start, have been against that from the outset. They were for the second option, which essentially was to try and overturn Brexit altogether.
Yep.
Judging by, shall we say, the well-publicised fracas at the People's Vote campaign this week, that's part, I think, of the debate that's happening in that organisation too.
I think it's quite clear that even if somehow the House of Commons were to vote for another referendum, well, the People's Vote campaign isn't in any position to actually organise or run a campaign, and they would be the most logical group to actually take up that official mantle. So that's probably factoring into an awful lot of the Lib Dems and SNP's calculations as well.
It's a high stakes gamble, essentially. It's not one I would have made. And on the podcast, we were saying that we'd still be happy for Norway. I as an MP, would probably still vote for a deal that kept us in the single market and customs union. Instead, we are in a high stakes gamble where rather than, I still think that actually a key turning point could well be the voting down of the Norway Plus option.
Yep.
And any other options in the indicative votes that happened earlier in the year. If at the end of this snap election period we have a Johnson administration with a majority to pass a very hard Brexit, I think a lot of these manoeuvrings will be seen in a very negative light.
Yeah, from my perspective, I view a lot of those manoeuvrings in a negative light already. But you can definitely say that the eyes of history and future historians are not going to necessarily look kindly on basically naked political manoeuvring rather than actually looking in the country's interest.
First, they would argue it is in the country's interests to stay in the EU. I think it's more about the gamble. I'm not really a gambling person by nature, so it's not something that I would have done, but we'll have to see how it goes, I suppose. A couple of quick questions. We asked for listeners to send in their questions. Someone called Sally Haynes has sent in a couple of questions. Have you heard of a Sally Haynes?
No, doesn't ring a bell at all.
Not sure. No. A couple of questions. One was, what if the withdrawal agreement had a customs union attached? Which, I suppose, plays into these thoughts of whether or not you could try and soften the Brexit and also whether or not you could get this bill passed. My hunch is that a withdrawal agreement bill with a customs union might pass, given that, I was going to say, given Labour's position on Brexit, I think is to be in a customs union, it could pass.
Mm-hmm.
And then you've got a situation where Johnson maybe can't get the ERG votes for that. So the delicate parliamentary arithmetic might have been scrambled a little bit.
Yeah, but at that point, you probably end up in a situation where Johnson pulls the bill again. So I'm not convinced, actually, that it would get passed, just simply for that reason. I think it's quite clear that the government doesn't want to risk any amendments to anything at the moment, if they can get away with it. And I think that would hold true in that situation as well.
Mm, less scrutiny, the better, I think, as far as the government's concerned. The other question is, what was the difference between trying to push for an election on the 9th of December and pushing for an election on the 12th of December? I mean, these wranglings got incredibly tedious and confusing.
Very, very quickly, yeah. I mean, from the initial kind of conversation that came out about this was that it was all about like the student vote, and that that those three extra days would mean more students were in their constituencies at university rather than at home, which would therefore be more beneficial for effectively the left-wing parties, who tend to do better in heavily populated student areas. Broadly speaking, that's not accurate at all, based on the data that I've seen. Most students actually vote in their home constituency rather than their university one. And the 3 days either side probably isn't going to make that much of a difference either way.
And the other reason, I think, for a 9th of December election is if the election was on the 9th of December, there wouldn't be enough time to pass and scrutinise the withdrawal agreement coming through. I think it's the reason why the Lib Dems and the SNP were trying to push for the 9th of December.
Yeah.
Patrick Cook, who we are doing some transatlantic podcasts with, he asked a nice easy question. What's a realistic number of seats that a Remain alliance could flip? And similarly, what's the maximum number of seats the Tories could win if they do a pact with a Brexit party?
Right, let me get my abacus out and crunch the numbers for you.
A swingometer, I think.
Yeah, so if we do that, carry the four, add the six.
You can carry numbers on an abacus?
Oh, you can now.
Madness.
I mean, long story short, the answer is it could be anything. We are in a very volatile situation, to be quite honest with you. John Curtis, election guru, you know, somebody we'll be seeing an awful lot of on our TV screens for the next 6 weeks or so, and has already come out and said that this election has the potential to have up to 100 seats which will not be the Lib Dem, sorry, which will not be Labour or Conservative, which is a very, very high number. I think he's basically saying this could be the highest number of non-big two parties ever.
Look at him just going out on television, just making predictions.
And that's what happens when you're good at what you're making predictions, though, when you've got all the data to hand and you've been doing it for God knows how many decades. It is a very volatile situation overall, which means you could be, there's so many different potential outcomes that you can see a logical path to in some capacity. Everything from, you know, outright Conservative majority to maybe a small Labour majority to Lib Dems being the largest party if it reaches a critical match point and things like that.
You're just saying that to please Mark, aren't you?
Oh, 100%, yeah. We need to be kind to the future Lib Dem president.
He's probably doing a better get out the vote than most MPs, I think.
He probably is, yeah. Now, based on what I've seen so far, he absolutely is.
I'm going to try and answer Patrick's question with numbers. But so in terms of a realistic number of seats that a Remain alliance could flip, so there are 13 Tory-held seats in Scotland. There are 11 seats, I believe I'm right in saying, which are held by a Tory MP, where the Lib Dem was second with a majority of Remain voters yep. in it. Let's say those 24 go. So the Tories at the moment have a majority of minus 45. Take out another 24 seats, plus VAT. the Johnson strategy is to win over a lot of traditional Labour heartlands, as we've said. Well, say they don't manage to do that and Labour grinds out a lot, well, either grinds out a lot of victories kind of Peterborough style by locating its core vote and having a really good ground game, or sweeps to victory on the back of its amazing programme for social change. Delete is appropriate. Well, then you can probably get a parliament with a majority to get a referendum done. Bob's your uncle. On the other hand, the electoral calculus poll, this is just the day that we're recording, so we're recording this on Wednesday, says Tories to go to 363 seats, Labour to go down to 186, Lib Dems 31, SNP up to 48. That's a Tory majority of 76. Now, before we all start crying, we should emphasise that is just an electoral calculus prediction based on national swing, which doesn't really take into account individual constituency polling. So it's we're talking a back of envelope, maybe a sophisticated back of envelope calculation, but not much more than that.
We're only literally the first day, as we're recording this, the first day proper of people actually campaigning and starting to get things moving for this general election. If you looked at this in this stage of the campaign in 2017... well, guess what? Labour were massively behind the Tories by about as much as they are now, and ended up the campaign with you know, only one or two points behind them. Now, that's not to say that is guaranteed to happen, but it could. There are enough don't knows, which if they are essentially disaffected Labour voters and disaffected left wingers in one form or another, if those come home to Labour, you know what? Game on. Like, you've got a very different potential outcome happening there. We'll get a much better feel for that actually as the campaign rolls on. Probably within the next couple of weeks, we might start to see some of those don't knows coalescing somewhere.
And Kathy Draxelbauer asks us a question. Hello, Kathy, and John as well, if you're listening. And Kathy, again, also asks us a very easy question, which is, which outcome of the election would result in the quickest resolution of Brexit? To which, of course, the answer is...
inventing the time machine, going back and preventing the referendum from having happened in the first place.
Well, I was going to say, it's going to take 10 years come what may.
Yeah.
Obviously, if you're a Lib Dem who's been inspired by the hashtag backpack campaign, you're probably saying, what, the outcome that results in the quickest resolution of Brexit? I'll tell you what that is, Steve. It's a majority Lib Dem government, and they revoke Article 50, and everything is fine.
Oh, that ends the policy of Brexit, but it doesn't end the actual effects of it, though, overall, because effectively what you've done then is further radicalise the pro-Brexit forces in a way which will have repercussions probably for the next decade or so.
The extent to which the Lib Dems do well in the election, I think, is going to be really, really interesting.
Yeah, it will be fascinating to see.
A worst-case scenario is a bit of a Clegmania situation where the resources are spread far too thinly and therefore don't concentrate on their key seats. You could easily see that happening. I mean, the really, really worst case scenario is Jo Swinson only has a majority of 5,000.
And is in Scotland, where everything can go anywhere direction at the moment.
It could also be kind of Clegmania squared, couldn't it? Because if I was in Lib Dem HQ, I wouldn't really know where to focus my target seats. I suppose we've got a bit of a hint from where they've put, say, MPs like Sam Giamar, Chuka Umunna, Luciana Berger, in terms of those seats around central London or North London. But the impression I get, kind of trying to read some of the tea leaves around some of the Lib Dem figures, is I think the Lib Dems think, well, we're polling already about 20-odd%, maybe late teens. There's a critical mass when it reaches 23, 24, 25%. And they think, well, actually, then if it reaches that much, suddenly, rather than getting 30, 40, 50 seats, we start thinking about 130, 40, 50 seats. So let's just humour for a second. Let's say there's a Lib Dem government. Let's say there's a big surge. Jo Swinson does well at the debates, or equally, as might happen, is excluded from those debates, and the Lib Dems get massive momentum on the back of that. There's a secret memo that comes out from Andrew Murray saying that Labour's going to leave the EU come what may, do or die on January the 31st, and we have a Lib Dem government. Let's assume that's with 35% of the vote.
Yeah.
Let's assume then the Tories are squeezed by the Brexit Party, so the Tories on about 25% of the vote, Brexit Party on about 15%. Let's also then assume that Labour on between about 20 and 25%. Well, if we had a Lib Dem majority government in that situation, you would be in a position where actually, potentially, more people, if you look at the combined Tory and Brexit Party vote, more people voted for parties committed to a hard Brexit or a no-deal Brexit than actually voted for a revoke option. And yet we end up revoking at the end of that period. And so, as you say, the politics of that would not be resolved at all. And I mean, you always see the old patronising comment from those on the hashtag FPPEers, don't you? With a, oh, well, no one would notice if we just revoked. But I think there would be a backlash, and I think we really have to acknowledge that there would be one.
Yeah, and I think fundamentally that's why, actually, if you do want to cancel Brexit, then that's what the referendum needs to be. The way to do it, because essentially that means the decision goes back to the British people, and it's a lot harder to argue against, oh, the British people changed their mind, than, oh, the politicians have sabotaged this.
So let's have a think about what might be more, an apologist to any Lib Dems listening, what might be the more realistic way in which Brexit maybe is cancelled quickly. Yeah. And that is, we have a Labour government either winning a majority or, as part of a coalition or confidence and supply agreement, they enact Labour policy, which is to negotiate a soft Brexit, put forward plans for a referendum, and put soft Brexit versus Remain on the ballot paper. And let's say the British public then vote for that. Well, the Constitution Unit say that a referendum can be arranged in 22 weeks. So if we assume, say, a Labour government gets down with that end of December or beginning of January, we are looking at a referendum with a potential Remain vote June, July. Done. And again, at that point, you've still got some unresolved politics, but I think there's a definite line in the sand that you can draw.
Yeah, you can definitely, as we said, it's gone back to the people. The people have voted again. The people have changed their mind. Yes, the hardcore Brexiteers may go, well, this is what the EU always does. They just ask the same question until they get the response they like. But it's a lot harder to make that case.
So I think in answer to Cathy's question, the quickest probably is a Labour kind of administration by July, potentially. Of course, the flip side of that, and I mean, have I mentioned Joe Owen? I don't think I have. Have I?
No.
A lot of this is coming from Joe Owen from the Institute for Government, who's talked about half a dozen potential Brexit scenarios. We've got that was the first one, was no Brexit under Labour government. Of course, the second scenario then is a Labour Brexit, in which a soft Brexit is negotiated. Probably, Britain remains part of the single market customs union, but the public vote for a deal and we leave with a soft Brexit.
I mean, I can't see that being very likely at all, just because in order for that to happen, I feel like the Labour Party machinery would need to come out in favour of the soft Brexit deal itself, which it's just not going to do. Even if officially it does, the reality is the vast majority of Labour campaigners are going to back the Remain option that's on that referendum. So I think that's just so unlikely to happen.
And I suppose if we assume it's a soft Brexit on the ballot paper, the thought, I can't see Nigel Farage touring up and down the country campaigning for a soft Brexit. He'll probably just be shouting betrayal from the sidelines.
Yeah.
Third scenario is a kind of Labour stasis, what I would call the reverse May. Which is that a Labour administration takes power either with a small majority or with Lib Dem SNP support, and they don't have the numbers for a second referendum, essentially because too many Labour MPs rebel against that position. Let's say, hypothetically, 20 Labour MPs don't vote for a second referendum. Now, I think this is quite unlikely because, and something we'll probably talk about in a later podcast, lots of MPs are standing down. I think we're looking about 60 MPs now standing down, a huge amount of people. In terms of those people who are standing down, a lot of them are Labour rebels on Brexit. Kate Hoey, John Mann, Joe Fitzpatrick, Ronnie Campbell, to name just four off the top of my head, all standing down. So I think a Labour Party PLP at the end of this election cycle is probably a more united PLP on Brexit, I would say.
Yeah, I think that probably is quite accurate. I can't see there being particularly that many Labour MPs after all of this wanting to support a deal of some capacity. Especially in this scenario, Labour's actually done quite well in the election. It's enough to at least form a minority government in some capacity, which means those who were anxious about losing their seats, like say maybe someone like Gareth Snell up in Stoke-on-Trent, I think it is.
Yeah,
he's fine. He's now got 5 years.
Well,
so he's not going to be worrying about it. So he'll probably back the back a referendum rather than going against it.
And I suppose the other thing is Labour's going to this election presumably with a manifesto commitment to a public vote on Brexit. So Gareth Snell has cover there as well, I would say, from his constituents.
Yeah.
Then the fourth scenario Joe Owen has is the no deal scenario, in which we have, and this sounds horribly plausible, we have a Tory minority government, or one that's needs to be backed up by the DUP or the Brexit Party, and the price of that party propping up the government is essentially to junk part or all of the withdrawal agreement bill. At which point we could well be heading for a no-deal January Brexit.
Yep.
Let's not worry about that yet.
No, it's not likely to happen, I would say, just because I just can't see the Brexit Party getting enough seats to make it warranted. And I think the situation in Northern Ireland is such that the DUP would probably waver at the end of the day.
But I can see a situation where the Tories are the largest party but can't form an overall majority and don't want to reach out to the Lib Dems or SNP, or maybe the SNP and Lib Dems refuse to.
Yeah.
I can see that happening. But I think we should worry about that on December the 13th.
Yeah.
Fifth scenario is a slim Tory majority where the withdrawal agreement is passed, but Boris Johnson is unable to reach a compromise with his party for the next stage of the Brexit process. Which, again, I think is horribly likely.
Yeah, this is basically where we end up in the delayed hard Brexit, I suppose, with that 2020 deadline. Because, obviously, the extension is obviously only for the transitional period, which will last for about a year or so.
Yeah, and your extension probably has to be agreed about June time, and there's
probably very, very difficult for the government to get that through, given the makeup of the Conservative benches, and without them securing a majority to make that happen, and basically, a lot of people feeling like they owe Boris Johnson their jobs, probably not going to happen.
The sixth, final one is a blank check Brexit,
yeah.
A big Tory majority which gives Johnson wiggle room to essentially do the compromises he may need to engender. I mean, this is what Theresa May was hoping for 2.5 years ago.
Yeah.
So they're the kind of Brexit scenarios sketched out, like a kind of choose your own adventure story of doom. We've got a final question from Cathy, which I suppose will let us can let us think about the first 2 weeks of the campaign, which is, it seems to me that Corbyn pushing Johnson promised we'd be out by the 31st of October and he lied will backfire spectacularly, because Johnson has played this well and the public will think he tried and was thwarted by Labour. Do you agree, or does it still carry weight?
I think this is very much a message which isn't necessarily aimed at waverers to get people to vote Labour. I think this is a message which is aimed at waverers who were thinking about voting Tory but are very disappointed that Brexit hasn't happened. All of the hypothetical polling about how people would vote in an election if Brexit hadn't been delivered by the 31st of October suggested that Boris Johnson or Theresa May or whoever, basically if they weren't able to deliver it in some capacity, would take a massive hit to the amount of votes they were getting leading over to the Brexit party. I think this is essentially Labour trying to make that point so that they can try and drive a wedge between potential Tory waivers and the Tory party itself by just highlighting, he said he'd do this, he hasn't done it. You got this matters to you guys. You should vote on that. And whilst they're not necessarily going to come vote Labour off the back of it, it benefits Labour to make that argument, because if the Brexit party ends up picking up votes, that's at the Tory party's expense, most likely, rather than Labour's. As such, makes it easier for them to win seats.
I think the other thing is, it's about just showing this isn't someone whose word you can trust.
Yeah.
And so it was interesting that PMQs happened the day that we're recording this, that Corbyn led on the NHS on the implications of a deal with Trump's America for the NHS and Brexit, especially on the back of a Dispatches episode on NHS drugs and the possible price increases we might have under a trade deal. And so, again, essentially, I think it's trying to merge the two points together. It's saying Johnson says the NHS isn't on the table. Johnson says that it'll be fine, there won't be any more privatisation. Well, actually, he said that we'd be out by the 31st of October. That didn't happen. Can you trust his word on this?
Yeah, and that combination of things is something that's very much aimed at your Labour Brexiteers up north, who are the ones that are, in theory, the people that the Conservatives are going to be sweeping up as they kind of march across the north and kick Labour MPs out of their seats. The reality is that's probably not going to be the case, in my opinion. Bold prediction, potentially, and I'll almost certainly somehow be proven wrong. But that combination of the message seems very much aimed at them. He couldn't deliver on what he told you he would. He's incompetent. Also, he's not trustworthy. And we know he's not trustworthy, and because of that, you can't trust him on these things which really matter to you. The NHS, making sure that the NHS is efficient and working and all of those sorts of things. In a lot of ways, it's a standard Labour play. Like every election since this has basically been formed, Labour have run on the Tories are trying to... you've got X mini tie days to save the NHS. It was a classic kind of campaign byline. But in this instance, the combination of things, I think, makes it more likely to be effective.
I think it underlines what a gamble it is from the Tory side, because Jeremy Corbyn already looks happier now an election's been called.
Yeah.
And it's a bit of a cliche, isn't it? But he is a campaigner. He likes campaigning. This is what he's good at. From what we've seen of Boris Johnson, I don't know if that's necessarily true. There's certainly I can see a scenario in which he falls apart in a kind of very Theresa May-esque fashion. Equally, and this is why the election, I think, is so hard to call, because the best case scenario for Labour is those don't knows, as you were saying, flip to Labour, Boris Johnson falls apart, there's lots of tactical voting to oust him in Scotland and the South, and suddenly you've got a parliamentary majority to a referendum and potentially remaining in the European Union. On the other hand, you can see a situation where the attacks on Jeremy Corbyn that backfired in 2017 maybe somehow cut through, because this time he is seen as being
more potentially a prime minister.
And then you can almost see the Tories potentially picking up 40-50 seats. Maybe because, again, fewer people vote tactically in those seats because people vote Lib Dem and Green in those seats rather than Labour, because they want to show a vote for a definite pro-Remain party rather than, and are exasperated at Labour's more nuanced position, shall we say.
Yeah.
And it's really hard to tell. And I think the thing is, it will depend seat by seat by seat. And because we have a rubbish voting system, I think the election will be affected by very small swings of votes in very small seats. And I think we're going to see a lot of three, maybe even four-way marginals with very, very small majorities.
Yeah.
And we could, and you could see also seats with massive majorities going the other way and being overturned. It's going to be interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, as they say, may you live in interesting times.
We should go knock some doors.
I mean, suppose. Do we have to? It's dark out.
It's 2 PM, Steve. It's going to be well, someone who's been a campaigner longer than I have, they talked about, I think, did a by-election a decade or two ago in Dudley West on the 12th of December, and it was dark on 3:30 on polling day. So that's what we've got to look forward to. But the other interesting thing we haven't talked about that we won't spend too much time talking about, the impact of a winter election when we now have postal votes, when a lot of campaigning will take place online, that dimension I think will be particularly interesting.
Yeah, I mean, it will be quite fascinating to see how the campaigns will adapt to that. To be honest, it'll probably just be doubling down on their already existing digital strategies. The Tories will throw money at it, the Labour will hope, and they're already seeing this with their election launch video, which went out, I think, earlier today or yesterday, which essentially has gone viral.
We'll have episodes coming out regularly, both about the election campaign, but also podcasts on other issues as well. If you have any questions that you'd like us to talk about in the next episode on the election, we'll probably record that in a couple of weeks' time. Feel free to send them in. We are on Twitter at NoChampagnePod. We have a Facebook page, which is facebook.com/NotEnoughChampagne. And we have a website, which is NotEnoughChampagne.com. James Cram designed our logo. You can follow him on Twitter at James Cram. And Dave Depp is responsible for our theme tune, Plucky Good Times. I'm at Paperback Rioter.
I'm at Acoustic Radical.
Happy plotting.